Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. For the last 10 years or so, many scholars have focused on misinformation, the false facts that end up in people's heads because of fake news or propaganda. But what if that's not the most important way that Americans misunderstand the way this country works? Political scientist Emily Thorson argues that policy misperceptions, false beliefs people hold about what the government does, are more consequential than more politicized bad information about President Obama's birthplace or even the death panel lies about the Affordable Care Act. She'll tell us why right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Sometimes a book just has the perfect title. Emily Thorson's new book, The Invented State, is one of them. Her scholarship looks at how and why people come to hold false beliefs about a wide variety of issues, whether they're highly politicized, like immigration at the border, or less well-known bits of government functioning, like which countries hold the American government's debt. Her crucial observation is that people often have filled in the blanks between the various political schemes that they hear about and the actual world that they see around them. Unfortunately, they don't always fill in the policy details very well, and that leads them to have a distorted view of what the government is actually doing. Thorson joins us from Syracuse this morning, where she's an assistant professor of political science. This is part of our Doing Democracy series, which examines what democracy means and how it's practiced. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So in your introduction, you bring up this widely held misperception that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, which of course is not true. But you write that while startling and troubling, that is not the most dangerous kind of misinformation. Why not? And what is?
Well, the thing about the misperception that Obama was not born in the United States is that people are concerned about it because, understandably, they worry that someone hears Obama wasn't born in the U.S. and then decides, oh, I'm not going to like that guy. I'm not going to vote for that guy. But what we know from decades of research is that usually it happens the other way around, that people first say, I don't like Obama, and then they choose to believe that misinformation about him, right? Mm. And so it's not that the misinformation is affecting their attitudes, it's that their attitudes are affecting what they choose to believe. And because of that, I'm a little less concerned about the possibility for that particular piece of misinformation to change people's attitudes. Rather, it usually just reinforces attitudes they already have.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is this concept that you introduced. It's new to me, at least, that's called voter competence. But it doesn't mean people's ability to kind of fill in the bubbles. So what's the working definition of voter competence in this field?
Well, when I talk about voter competence in the book, I draw on a lot of scholarship that says, you know, we don't necessarily need people to know everything, right? You don't need to be able to name every state capital, no matter what your fourth grade teacher told you. But what you do need to know is the issues and policies that affect you. Some things matter to you, and you want to have correct information so that you can vote in line with your underlying values and preferences, right? If you are extremely pro-life, we want to make sure that you are voting for the pro-life candidate, right? That is how democracy should be functioning.
Mm. So when it comes to misinformation and these sort of misperceptions, like, give us a couple of examples of what distinguishes between those two things.
Well, I talk in the book about how, in some ways, the more politicized a piece of or a misperception is, the more it's tied up with someone's party identity, the more likely it is to be a product of people's political attitudes rather than something that affects those attitudes, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about really high-profile politicians, be that Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Donald Trump, it tends to be the case that any given piece of information about those people is really not going to shape attitudes one way or the other, whether the information is true or false. Because your opinion about Donald Trump, whether you like him or you hate him, it's pretty locked in at this point, right? And that's because it's tied up with your partisan identity and because you know so much about him already. But when it comes to policy, when it comes to policies like Social Security or the national debt, kind of misperceptions have a greater potential to affect attitudes for two reasons. One, policies, especially longstanding policies, are often not as politicized. They're not as wrapped up in people's party identity. Republicans and Democrats both like Social Security, right? The other reason is that the knowledge base is just a lot smaller. You know, people know less about TANF, Temporary Aid for Needy Families, than they do about Joe Biden. And so any additional piece of information, whether it's true or false, is going to have a bigger impact on their attitudes towards that policy.
We're talking about political misinformation and misperceptions and what to do about them with Emily Thorson, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Syracuse. What we'd love to hear from listeners today is whether you've ever changed your mind about a complex policy issue after being presented with new facts or information. You can email forum@kqed.org with the story of sort of how you changed your mind about that complex policy issue. Or you can give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And we're just asking how if you've changed your mind about a policy issue after being presented with new facts or information. I think it's become pretty common, Emily, among, I would say, particularly liberal people. Like you quote Paul Krugman, for example, writing in the New York Times, facts not only don't win arguments, they make people on the wrong side dig in even deeper. I've heard similar things, though, from people in the climate communication movement, for example, many others. And it's this idea that we're in a post-truth world. Does your research align with that?
No. And in fact, most of the empirical research on fact-checking and on the effects of information does not align with that. We have a lot of evidence now from a lot of experiments. Alex Kopic at Yale has a great book called Persuasion in Parallel that shows that information pretty much makes everybody more accurate. It moves everybody in the direction that it's supposed to. So if you give Republicans or Democrats accurate information, it moves them in the direction it should. There's not a backfire effect. People don't resist facts, right? And I think what's frustrating to people is that sometimes facts, and I guess as you would say, don't matter because people's attitudes are so strong. Because if you feel really strongly that you are going to vote for Joe Biden, that he's the best guy for the job, then maybe a new additional piece of information shouldn't sway you, right? It's okay to have strong opinions. So one of the things I want to do is push back against this idea that every little piece of information should change people's attitudes.
Right, you'd just be swinging around wildly if it was that way,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's okay to have the courage of your convictions and the strength of your convictions, and especially when it comes to partisanship, right? Democrats will tolerate a lot of kind of reprehensible behavior from their people if it means their people can be in power. Same with Republicans. And there's good reason for that.
So let's talk about a couple of the main arguments of the book. I mean, this concept of the invented state draws on another scholar's work, a woman named Suzanne Mettler, about what she calls the submerged state, this kind of stuff that the government does that's kind of invisible to most people. And then your extension basically says, well, what happens when people fill in the government policy between that invisible state and what they see around them, right?
And this stemmed from kind of the book starts off with me actually doing interviews with people, sort of asking them to describe policies, right? Asking them to describe how welfare policy works, asking them to describe how immigration policy works. And I was really struck by how people sort of struggled to tell a coherent factual story. They clearly cared about these policies and were interested in them, but just didn't have access to the information that they needed to build a representation of that policy that reflected reality and what was really going on.
Give me an example of that.
Well, in one study, I really zoom in on the area of refugee policy, right? And refugees are in the news a lot. There's a lot of coverage of refugees. But when I started actually asking people about how refugee policy worked, right? And refugee policy, sort of the basic parameters of it, has been around for decades. You know, presidents change sort of the number of refugees who are admitted, but the basic process of refugee admission has been the same for a very long time. You know, there are really substantial background checks that people undergo. For example, there's the government works with religious organizations and other organizations to do the actual resettlement. So these kind of processes have been in place for a long time, but people just had no idea they existed. Right. This is existing policy and people did not know that it was there. And so that is, and when they don't know, right, when you don't know how a policy works, you do try to sort of fill in the blanks and figure out, okay, well, how does it work? What's my best guess as to how it might work? And this is what I call the invented state. These sort of policy misperceptions that people come up with using inductive reasoning to figure out how policies work in the absence of sort of media coverage or other sources of information.
And so, I mean, one of the things that's complex about this, and in the case of refugees, for example, if you would like to stop refugees from coming into this country, it is to your advantage to have people not understand that there's a rigorous process, right? So they, even the things that people don't know, like those blanks of knowledge, are themselves kind of political creations too, no?
Absolutely. And I think one of the inferences that I would make from my book, one of the lessons from that, is that it would be a good idea for people in elected office and for the media to sort of say more about what policies actually look like, to sort of inoculate people against potential misinformation or misperceptions forming, right? It's a lot easier to misinform someone in a vacuum, as we learned during COVID, than it is to misinform them when they already have a base of information.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that I found hilarious and also kind of comforting in your book is how far back in time people were taking kind of a dim view of how people formed their worldviews or like their factual models for how the world works. You cite Walter Lippmann, for example, you know, eminent 20th century journalist who writes, "This trickle of messages from the outside is affected by the stored up images, the preconceptions and prejudices which interpret, fill them out, and in their turn powerfully direct the play of our attention and our vision itself." And it kind of goes to this idea that the world is a very complex place and it's so difficult to understand. Do you think it's harder or easier than it was when Walter Lippmann wrote that, say, in 1922?
I will give a very academic answer and say it's different, right?
I thought both and was the academic answer. <Yeah. laughs>
we now, one of the things has that one of the major developments in the media environment over since Walter Lippmann was writing is just the fragmentation of the media environment, and that now people are getting information from so many different sources that there's not kind of one coherent narrative like, say, the nightly news provided maybe 50 years ago. And so I think that does potentially make it harder for people to get on the same factual page.
Yeah. We're going to talk a lot more about the media's role in some of these problems of political misperception, what to do about them, with Emily Thorson, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Syracuse. We want to hear from you. Have you ever changed your mind about a policy issue after being presented with new facts or new information? I know for me, doing Forum, it actually happens quite often. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can find us on all the different social channels, or you can give us a call, 866-733-6786. This is all part of our Doing Democracy series, examining kind of the innards of our democracy. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Star One Credit Union provides you with the tech, tools, and terms to control your money and your lifestyle. Simple, seamless, everyday financial services and solutions. Online and mobile banking backed by the latest technology. Great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. And real people providing real assistance when you need it. At Star One, they always put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or visit any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union. In your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about political misinformation as well as misperceptions and what to do about them. We're joined by Emily Thorson, assistant professor at Syracuse in the Department of Political Science. She wrote the book, The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. So there's no finer tradition in American media than self-flagellation. So how much of policy misperceptions is the fault of the media? Like, how specifically do you think the media has failed people?
Well, my concern with the media, and I detail this in a couple of content analyses in the book where I sort of examine about a decade's worth of media coverage, is that the media does a great job of talking about what politicians plan on doing, right? Policy proposals. What does Trump plan on doing? What does Biden plan on doing? And they do a pretty good job of providing information about policy outcomes. So the ACA has reduced the uninsured rate. What they don't do a great job of is providing information about what existing policy actually does. How does Social Security work, right? How does refugee policy work? And there are, I think, really good reasons for that. It's not new. It's not novel. The idea of media, your show may be accepted, is that you always want to provide breaking news, be the first thing, right? And policy proposals meet that perfectly. But telling people, again, how Medicare works doesn't really meet that novelty requirement. Mm-hmm. The other reason is that I think it's hard for journalists to truly comprehend how little people know, right? Because, and I'm not criticizing people here. People are busy. They've got a lot going on. It's tough to know the ins and outs of every policy. But if you're a journalist who's been on the Medicare beat for 10 years, and I have friends who are that journalist, it's hard to believe that people don't understand the basic facts of Medicare, right? And we call this the curse of knowledge. It's always hard to kind of comprehend the depth of ignorance when you are an expert in something. Mm.
Also, some of these systems are so remarkably complex that actually few people actually understand their innards, right? I mean, we had Jennifer Palka on the show talking about sort of policy implementation within, you know, different government agencies. And in some of these agencies, only some dozens of people actually understand how, you know, things are supposed to flow within that particular agency. And so it's a pretty tough, pretty tall order, I think, to imagine that media can translate from sort of that level of specificity to what people need to know, right, about how that policy works.
I'm going to push back a little bit because I don't think people need to know that level of specificity, right? Mm-hmm. And this gets back to the democratic competence point that you brought up earlier, is that you don't need to know every single detail of how a policy is implemented. You just need to know sort of how it affects you and the basics of how it works. So I do think that there's a middle ground, and we shouldn't say, well, we can't make a perfect representation of policy in people's heads, so therefore we shouldn't do it at all. Mm-hmm. You know, I think right now we have almost no coverage of existing policy, and it might be impossible to get perfect coverage, but there is a middle ground where you can give people sort of the basic facts. And in my research, I find people really like this kind of coverage, that mm-hmm. they are interested in it.
You know, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, we mostly deal with local issues. We talk about national things, obviously, too, but local issues here. I mean, one of the things that is true is if you were to get the top level narrative about what policy around homelessness is supposed to do in San Jose or San Francisco or Oakland, you'd get one story. But if you did go to the like implementation details and talk to the people who are doing it, you'd get like a totally different story. So I think that's one reason why, at least to me, it feels like the basic policy facts are good for people to have. But it might, again, leave a gap in people's knowledge that they'll end up filling in because it doesn't actually agree with what they're seeing in the street.
I think that's fair. I do think that when it comes to sort of talking across partisan lines, or maybe even not partisan lines, but kind of policy differences, contentious, it's important to start from kind of the same ground. And talking about the facts of policy, what does refugee policy actually do? What does Social Security do? Getting people on that same page provides a really good starting point for I think more productive deliberation than, for example, talking about what is this policy supposed to do? What are the outcomes of this policy? So it's the difference between saying, what does the policy do versus is it working or not, right? The second is a much more fraught question than what is it actually doing?
You know, this is kind of interesting, too, because it goes to perhaps why information on current or existing policy is more effective at changing attitudes, which is another thing that you find in the book, right? That if you give people information on how Social Security works, how refugee policy works, that's actually more effective at changing their attitude than telling them, well, if we were to change this or something, then, right?
Yeah, it is. And what I find is that when you give people information about outcomes, right? Like you say, for example, most refugees don't commit crimes. People say, well, I can explain away that fact, right? They address it, they're cooking the books, or well, they're doing it in a way that they can't be caught. They're not, their fingerprints aren't in the databases, right? It's easy to sort of explain away outcomes, largely because there's statistics, and it's easy to explain away and lie with statistics, as we know. Versus if you say, refugees are required to undergo strict background checks before they enter the United States. It is written down. I can point you to the place where it's written down. It's a legal requirement. It's harder to argue with that, right? Mm-hmm. It's harder to counter-argue it. And so that's one of the reasons why I think this type of information is more effective at shifting attitudes and at potentially kind of increasing confidence in existing policy. So if we think about existing policy, most of it is the product of a lot of negotiation and thinking and careful crafting. The people who make policy are, you know, really, I think, trying to do their best. And so when you expose people to this, then it makes them feel a little bit more positive towards the government, positive about what the government is actually capable of doing, right? It's not just a bunch of corrupt partisans out there. It's actually people doing this hard work of building infrastructure to make your life better.
Here comes our first caller, Michael in Walnut Creek. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to comment on my own story of how I've changed my opinion a little bit, and then I also have a question for the guest. I'm thinking specifically of how my family came to this country 2 generations ago. My grandparents were from Mazatlan, Mexico. And they were very wealthy and came to this country what they would say the right way. And so I'd always grown up thinking, oh, well, illegal immigrants need to get to the back of the line. My grandmother said that. My father said that. And in recent days, listening to the data and understanding the different perspectives of immigration now, it's not what it was in 1930, and it's not what it was for people who weren't as wealthy as them. So I've learned that get to the back of the line is not a reasonable perspective, and I've come to change my own personal opinion and my family story on that one.
That was really about learning how the immigration system itself works, like the as it works now. Yeah,
absolutely. A family anecdote doesn't compete with different data. But I'd also like to ask a question and clarification. I'll take my answer off the air. The guest mentioned policymakers explaining more of how policy works, and I suppose if I could put a little bit of words in, taking less of the culture wars and less of the big picture, and more of the how this is going to affect your day to day life and things. And I agree, but at the same time, I look at the data surrounding specifically Elizabeth Warren and Katie Porter, two people who are very wonky heavy, and I loved them both. And they appeal to people like me. They appeal to white, middle-class, college-educated folks, and other demographics aren't necessarily listening to their wonky policy making. So I just like to hear the perspective on that, because I do think that there's a limited capacity for growth there.
Michael, thanks for that question. What do you think, Emily?
I am very optimistic about the potential for information about current policy to reach a wide audience, and especially those who feel alienated by the current partisan tenor of a lot of media coverage. I actually just today got the results back from a survey I ran where I asked people kind of what they'd want to see more of in the media coverage. Would they want to see more kind of about the important conflicts between Democrats and Republicans, or more evaluation of policy and discussion of how policy works? 90% of people said the second. And this was consistent preference among income brackets, among Republicans, among Democrats. So I think there is an untapped appetite for this kind of policy talk.
You know, it's interesting because I think the survey data you presented in your book is pretty conclusive that people say they would like more of this information. I think, having worked in digital media before I came to radio. There's a lot of, like, I think in the field it's called revealed preference data, which is to say what people end up reading on the websites. And I think where a lot of the, I think, journalistic pushback on this would come from is, yeah, people say they want to read that stuff. But when we publish the thing about the royal person's hand being, like, moved around in a digitally altered photo, that's what everybody reads and talks about. And they're not reading about, you know, whatever policy prescription. I mean, it seems like maybe there's some truth in both, right? It's a little bit of the system one and system two thinking or something from Daniel Kahneman. There are people want maybe both things.
I think there's two things going on here. One is that if you look at the data that you're talking about, right? So if you are working for the Washington Post and you're looking at their traffic data, the people who are reading that are really different from the general public, right? And so they tend to be much more highly partisan, much more interested in politics, and have very different preferences. So if, as I think many news organizations should be, your goal is to grow audiences, you don't want to just meet the preferences of the people who are on your website right now. You also want to be designing content that brings in people who are overwhelmed or alienated by kind of the traditional partisan tenor of news. That's kind of point one. It's also the case that, yeah, I don't think policy coverage can compete with, you know, Princess Charlotte's weird hand, right?
That, like, why do we even know about that? Right? That was one of my questions. Yes,
but
go ahead.
What it can compete against is the, you know, horse race coverage, is the Biden changes strategy to beat Trump, people concerned about Biden's age, all of this, right? That people are really sick of that. And so if you are a news organization that has a limited amount of space for political content, I think you would be better served by filling that hole with policy content as opposed to more horse race coverage.
Let's bring in Elizabeth in San Rafael. Welcome.
Thank you. And so my question relates to that, and I'm wondering if the guest has any examples of really good explanations of policy. And what I'm getting at is, for example, I think California Healthcare Foundation does a really good job of explaining healthcare policy. And I used to do work where I had to explain sometimes things that were complex to audiences, and I would do my homework, and I'd get a very clear understanding. So, you know, is it the written word? Is it infographics, especially with short attention span? Schoolhouse Rock?
Hey, thank you, Elizabeth, for that. That's a great question. So kind of two points there, Emily. One, organizations you think are doing a good job of this. And two, is there something to the format? Are there format or media genre things that you think we should know that are particularly good for this kind of explanation?
Where I have seen a lot of this type of coverage is in local news, actually, partially because, you know, when you see in Syracuse, where I am, we have two big projects going on. They're tearing down the big thruway that runs down the middle of the city, and they're also building a big microchip factory. And so policy is being created to do this, and the local media are sort of the only people on the ground able to explain this. And they've done, I think, an extraordinary job of doing so. And so, again, partially because there isn't a partisan story. They can't just fall back on the Democrats versus Republicans. The only way to cover it is through the substance of what's actually being discussed and implemented. In terms of how to do it, we have a fair bit of research on how people learn. Certainly, I think infographics are helpful. I think bullets. I think, we can learn a lesson from BuzzFeed and places like that. 10 things you need to know right now about Social Security. Right? That's a compelling content for people. When there's been
10 things you need to know right now and have needed to know for 40 years about Social Security.
There's been a lot of research recently on this phenomenon called news avoidance, where there's a lot of people who just say they feel overwhelmed by news and they don't even know where to start. I think we've all felt this way at one time or another. I often feel this way. I study just domestic American politics. When I open sort of the international pages, I then immediately close it because I think I don't even know where to start. I don't understand the words that they're using. I can't jump in the middle here. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about how you kind of minimize that feeling of overwhelm, I think, is an important next step.
A couple of comments coming in from listeners as we talk with Emily Thorson. assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Syracuse University. We're talking about her book, largely, The Invented State, Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. People are answering the question, you know, when they change their mind or how they change their mind and, you know, how they've been informed. Holly writes in to say, perhaps debate training should be required in high school along with civics. My daughter had rock solid opinions about universal basic income, free public transit, etc. She had to argue the opposite of her original beliefs, and her opinion either turned around completely or, more importantly, was able to see the relative pros and cons of both sides. I had that experience myself of being a little young teen and completely changing my opinion on the death penalty, which, David writes, the one complex issue where I changed my mind over time is the death penalty. When I was younger, I felt the death penalty must be used to deter murder. Over time, I just learned how flawed the system is. I changed my mind about the discriminatory and potentially lethal misapplication of the death penalty. When you hear stories, when you or you have provided people with facts, how much do their opinions change, or their beliefs change, or their, I guess, their political outlook change?
It depends on the person, partially, right? If you take an example where a lot of people have sort of, I think, weak preferences, the idea of charter schools, right? Are charter schools a good thing or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. And so for many people, if you give them some sort of basic information about how charter schools work, the policy, they'll, you know, change their mind in one way or the other, right? It's not necessarily that it always makes you more supportive or less supportive. But then there's some people who have sent their kids to charter schools who have strong experience, and the information's not going to affect them. So again, it gets it back to this idea of how much information do you already have? The less information you have, the more likely it is that any additional facts are going to move you in one direction or another.
Mm-hmm. Another listener writes, I was extremely suspicious and opposed to the concept of universal basic income. This kind of backs up what you were just saying. The idea offended me. Then I spent a year working for the Employment Development Department, EDD, in California on unemployment programs, and it became clear that a universal policy would obviate the need for so much bureaucratic waste and entrenched failed policy. Couple other comments from people who have changed their minds. Two on Prop 1 and this here show forum. Stan writes, here's an example of when my policy decision changed. Based on a forum interview, I changed my mind and decided to vote against State Proposition 1 because it would take money from a lot of good existing programs. Another listener writes, I changed my mind about Prop 1. Initially, I planned to vote for it, but after listening to discussions on KQED, I decided to vote against it. So there's a couple examples, and I think, you know, it seems like there's a real opportunity, particularly around some of these propositions that come up in California and other places, to talk about current policy, because it is a big part of the story. It's not just the policy outcomes in the future. It's also what we're doing right now. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think taking those opportunities when they present themselves, and especially on these kinds of local issues, these issues that are not as politicized, right, that are not these culture war issues, you can really make a big difference by giving people information.
Yeah. We're talking about political misinformation and misperceptions and what to do about them. We're joined by Emily Thorson, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science there at Syracuse. She's the author of The Invented State, Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. We're going to get to more stories of you changing your minds and wanting to talk about other aspects of misperception and misinformation here in the United States. This is all part of our Doing Democracy series, which we're doing from now through the election. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking political misinformation and misperceptions. Joined by Emily Thorson, author of The Invented State, Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. Let's bring in more listeners. Arturo in Millbrae, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. What I would like to chime in is on misinformation. I feel like we have a miseducation with all things politics, and I feel like people come from different backgrounds, different societies, and have different levels of education. And when we don't have that form of education, we have misunderstanding and misinterpretation on things, and it leads us to do our fact check checking through ourselves or through groups of people. Now we live in this time of social media and the internet, and, or I should say the internet now social media, and we have all this fact checking. Quote, fact-checking, end quote, by other groups of people in other areas of the United States or the world, or a given area that you live in. So when it comes down to having an understanding of what a proposition is, what a or a local law, what we base our understanding is by what others see. And like, for example, my family, or my parents, I should say, they have a very low education. So when they see and they read given laws or whatnot on what to vote, they are so overwhelmed that they don't even understand what most of it that they're taking in. They only see the prop number and maybe what somebody else might have said or the news might have said. They will say, they'll be either yes or no, but with so much bias until somebody like myself will come in and explain it thoroughly and break it down piece by piece to letting them have an actual understanding of what this is.
Well, and Arturo, I'll say, you know, it's not just your parents. I mean, before I did Forum, you know, I reported a lot on the technology industry. I knew a lot about climate stuff because I'd been a science reporter. But, like, my web of knowledge about local issues was pretty sparse, you know? And I think sometimes when I would look at the different, you know, as a voter, you know, before I did the show, I would look at the local props and oftentimes I was like, I don't know. I mean, geez, should I even vote on this? I'm not sure I know enough to, or even can get myself informed enough to make a good decision. So it's not just your parents. Arturo, thanks. Thanks for that though. Appreciate your work you're putting in with your parents and for giving us a call. Emily, I mean, what is the relationship between education levels and the kind of misperceptions of policy that you're talking about?
This is a really interesting question, actually, because when it comes to politicized misinformation, like Barack Obama was born outside the United States, those types of things, higher education is associated with more misperceptions. Mm-hmm. And that is because being highly educated is also associated with being highly partisan. And as we said earlier at the beginning of the episode, you know, being partisan leads you to hold these misperceptions when it comes to these politicized ones. But for policy misperceptions, education actually leads to fewer misperceptions being held. But I think Arturo makes a really good point about sort of the importance of civic education. And, you know, if I could wave a magic wand and change some things, I would certainly have more coverage of policy in the media, but I would also have more coverage of or more education about how policies actually work in the K-12 school system as well, that we don't talk a lot about. There's not a unit on how Social Security works, right? There's Congress and there's the presidency and there's the division of powers, right? But we don't have this basic, here are some policies that have been around for decades and here's what they actually do. Here's how you get health insurance if you need to buy health insurance on the ACA exchanges. We don't really have any idea of the history of policy as well. So I think that would be really important. And finally, I would say that, you know, when Arturo is talking to his parents, that doesn't necessarily mean the system is broken, that a lot of people are, for whatever reason, kind of don't know much about politics, don't care much about politics. And so the fact that his parents have somebody knowledgeable who they can go to, what in the social science literature we call opinion leaders, is really helpful. And what I tell my undergraduate students is, we're political science majors, is to be an opinion leader. Don't be afraid of posting about politics on social media. Be the reasonable voice on social media telling people about what this new law actually does. That is
easy
really
for you to say,
to have
Emily.
Those voices.
You know, part of what you're describing in this book, and Arturo kind of gestured at this as well, is kind of a more successful or better method of fact checking. You know, and one of the things that I was thinking about, and we're talking about among, you know, producer Dan Dahl and Judy Campbell and I, just like, there has been a backlash against fact checking by a lot of news outlets. And I think one example is just how tricky it can get. And I'll just give one example from the book. You know, you cite the misperception that the wealthy pay less than 25% of their income taxes. And of course, like, the income tax bracket for wealthy people is 35%. So it's higher than that. But the capital gains tax rate is 20%. And that's really in investments where most wealthy people make their money, not to mention all the various schemes people use to shield their money. So the effective tax rate for very wealthy people can be very low. I mean, I think one White House study found it was something like between 6 and 12%. And so someone holding the perception that wealthy people pay less than 25% of their quote-unquote income is not actually a misperception, but of course it is. Like, both facts are also true. So that became, I think it's exactly things like that that became very difficult for, you know, fact-checking orgs. It wasn't just bald-faced lies. It's that the world is complicated, and the precise language that people use can make something sort of true or false, whether it's in spirit true or false.
Yeah, and I guess I would encourage maybe less focus on specific facts. I mean, that's how I sort of operationalize this in the paper or in the book, but and more on, we could think of almost as explanations, right? So it's not that we need people to know the exact percentage that wealthy pay on their taxes, that we want them to know basically that, yes, we have, there is such a thing as tax brackets, right? Which may seem, well, obviously everyone knows that. Do they? Right? Yeah, that kind of here is how our taxation system actually works. Here's what a capital gains tax is, right? So again, giving people that sort of scaffolding that they need to then form opinions down the road, as opposed to focusing over much on whether any one fact is true or false.
Well, and what about, one question I had was, if you give the rationale, like, you know, capital gains, you know, people would say capital gains taxes are lower to encourage investment, which drives blah, blah, blah. Like, you give people that, the rationale for that policy. Like, you don't even get to the outcome. And you say, well, but also it leads to inequity on the other side. And so we shouldn't have, like, does that rationale, like, is that helpful or not helpful?
I think more information is always helpful to the extent that people have the capacity to absorb it and use it.
Let's bring in another caller. Michael in San Francisco. Welcome. Hey, Michael, you there? Yeah, we might have lost him. Let's get to a couple more changing your mind stories. Kyle writes in to say, I used to believe the U.S. was incompetent at building public transportation infrastructure. But then I heard an explanation about how in the U.S., most of the cost is about redirecting utilities, which can make up the majority of a project's cost and time. You know what's interesting about this one? I wondered how this worked in your research. That sort of explanation, where you realize, like, it's not incompetence, it's legacy systems, it's like a bunch of these other factors. Does that lead people to have, I guess I want to say, a different opinions about the government in other sectors? You know, like, I would imagine maybe Kyle, the next time they look at homelessness services programs, might not assume that it's just incompetence, right?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point, that when we have, humans have a basic tendency to what I call in the book attribute intentionality, that when we see something going wrong, a policy isn't working, you know, the bus isn't coming on time, it's someone's fault. Someone is doing something bad, right? And often it is a much more complicated story than that. And if we can get people, like you said, thinking about systems rather than thinking about individual responsibility, I think that's a step in the right direction.
Trish writes in with sort of a a little pushback, perhaps. Could your guest say more about her statement that facts can change people's opinions? In my experience, if people are passionate about a belief, facts to the contrary are strenuously resisted and can't really be heard. Doesn't the brain feel threatened by challenges to deep beliefs and identity, so it goes into survival mode and reacts accordingly? That is, goes into survival mode and can't process the threatening information.
Absolutely. If it's a really deeply held belief, then an additional piece of information is probably not going to make a difference. If you try to tell me that coffee is going to kill me, no matter how many medical studies you throw at me, I will not believe it. I am thoroughly committed to believing that coffee is my savior, right? But that's a minority of issues for most people, right? That there's a, yes, we have some issues that we care deeply about and are dug in and invested on, but there's a lot more that we are open to new information on. And I think that fact-checking as an enterprise has been so focused on the highly politicized Trump, Biden, Obama pieces of fake news and has really ignored this huge universe of issues where people are, I think, really open to new information and accurate information.
Hmm. Of course, you know, in our discourse, the second something like that would start gaining some heat, then it would be newly hit by a whole bunch of waves of misinformation, right? I mean, I think that's one of the issues. It's like, this seems, it becomes way more complex once an issue is, you know, on the front burner in national politics.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Brooke in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was loving what the...
No.
The person, because they already have an opinion. Hello? Can you hear
me? Oh, yeah. We can hear you. Go ahead.
There. I had a comment, question about what your guest had said about how the fake news doesn't really change the opinion of the person. It usually, they have an opinion of the person, and so then the fake news, they just choose to believe in it. And my comment is, I'm wondering if that's why things get so heated when you criticize a person's political candidate. It's because you're not criticizing them, you're criticizing the person's belief.
Mm-hmm.
So the person takes it as an attack upon themselves, and therefore they get heated. And as we know, study or history has shown that if you criticize a person's belief, they tend to double down on that belief. And mm-hmm. so that's my comment.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for that, Brooke. I mean, what do we know from your other research too, Emily, and other people in the field who work on this, about presenting this kind of information, stuff where it is highly politicized? Are there ways to do it, or is that where we're getting into the hopeless territory?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between two different effects of corrective corrective information, right? So a fact check, right? One thing it can do is change people's beliefs, right? Make them more accurate. So if you're exposed to a fact check, you become more accurate. The next question is whether that also has downstream effects on attitudes. And in the book, I argue that that second step is what we really haven't talked enough about, is that it is the case that fact checks do make people more accurate. You know, they're not perfect. They're not a panacea. They're not going to work when people are really, you know, built in and doubled down and their values are involved. But on average, fact checks make people more accurate. But when it comes to these really politicized issues, they don't then have a downstream effect on their attitudes. It doesn't then say, okay, well, in that case, I'm not going to vote for Trump, right? You don't have that second step because people are kind of dug into their pre-existing political preferences. And as the caller said, those political preferences are tied up with their identity. So I think when you're talking about sort of do fact checks work, we often conflate, do they work at making people more accurate, and do they work
to
at
make you agree with
affecting
me.
People's attitudes? Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Let's bring in Daniel and Davis. Welcome, Daniel.
Hello. I have an observation, and I'm a retired scientist, and there is a method in science for imparting information to other people. And it's a method that was evolved over hundreds of years. And it's very simple. First of all, you have a topical title of some sort that brings people's attention. Mm-hmm. And then you might have a sentence or two that tells them what you're going to tell them. and then you might have a little bit of an introduction that sets it in the current stage mm-hmm. of things, and then you have the meat. You know, you actually have details and so on, and then you might have some conclusions, and you have a discussion. So you're basically telling them what you're going to tell them. You tell them what you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. And that structure of relating information is not used in the common media, and it's just a shame because mm-hmm. it's very effective. It's a way, you know, in science, I might read a paper that I don't know anything about. I don't understand the words. I don't know the factual details of how things are done or whatever. And so I need to have an introduction. Yeah. I need to be coaxed through the process of learning a little bit.
So that you can evaluate the evidence. More clearly. Yeah. Daniel, that's a great point. Let me take it, just because we're getting to the end of the show, let me take it over to Emily. Thanks so much for that. You know, are there things from the way, you know, science or other fields do information presentation that you feel like the media specifically, forums specifically, can borrow to try to increase the kind of uptake of facts and information that are correct?
I think that this is an empirical question, that one of the things I would like to see media outlets do is engage in more experimentation, but experimentation not with the goal of how do we get more clicks, but how do we get more learning, right? Mm. And I think by sort of partnering with survey firms and using reader panels and really using kind of social scientific methods, we could better get a better sense of how do we cover politics and policy in a way that really engages people and helps them learn.
So you're writing the grant, right?
I have 2 grant proposals out right now. So yes.
We're talking about political misinformation and misperceptions and what can be done about them with Emily Thorson. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Syracuse University and also author of The Invented State: Policy Misperceptions in the American Public. Lots of amens for you in different places. Noelle says, I wholeheartedly agree that we need to learn about how policy works. There has to be a way to present information that lands right depending on the person. I find that media coverage in general can be too superficial and predictable. Roger writes, I find it so useful to read the background on a proposition by the legislative analyst or the staff report on a city council issue to understand where we are starting on an issue. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Emily Thorson.
Thank you so much for having me.
The 9 o'clock hour forum is produced by Gray Swan, Blanca Torres, and Dan Zoll. Our interns are Emiko Oda and Annie Burton. Marlena Jackson-Rotondo and Jennifer Ng are our engagement producers. Francesca Fenzi is our digital community producer. She's on the Discord all the time. You can find her. If you don't know how to get to that, you can go to kqed.org/forum. Judy Campbell is lead producer. Danny Bringer and Brendan Willard are our engineers. Our vice president of news is Ethan Tovin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.